women and heart attack symptoms, recounting a day in the paramedic's life, charged for attacking EMS providers, and we'll take a look at the recent outbreak of meningitis at a U.S. university with a review of bacterial meningitis. If that's what you're looking for, you found it right here on this week's episode of The MedicCast.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is The MedicCast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the PodMedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of The MedicCast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the PodMedic, and I'd like to welcome you to this week's show. I've got a great show coming up for you this week, including a look at a recent study I found on diagnosing women with myocardial infarction using the typical symptoms reported by women. Then, after this week's three news items, we'll take a look at the recent bacterial meningitis outbreak at Princeton University and how EMS providers can review their diagnostic and treatment options for this rare disease. That's coming up later on in this week's Tip of the Week. Before we get to that, though, I do want to make sure that you are checking out the information and finding the additional links and resources available for you over at the MedicCast blog. You'll find that over at mediccast.com/blog. There's a show notes link at the top of the page. Just click that link and you'll be able to go right to the most recent episodes. And you can scroll down there and find whichever episode you're looking for if you're looking for a past episode. There's also a search box there on the site, so if in the upper right-hand corner, if you're looking for something in particular that we may have covered over the last, 8 or 9 years, go ahead and take some time to do that. But make sure you follow up on the information you get on the show. Understand how it applies to your own EMS practice and protocols. If you want to get back in touch with me, make sure you do so. I love to hear from you. You're part of the family here. You're part of the audience. So email me at podmedic@mac.com. You can email me with comments or questions on the shows. Make a suggestion or an interview idea for a future episode. Whatever the case may be, I work hard to respond back to every email that comes in, and I will get back to you as well. So please keep those emails coming. Also, don't forget, if you're an iPhone, an Android, a Windows Phone, or a Windows 8 user, make sure you check out the free MedicCast app available for you in your device's store. Just another way for you to get the MedicCast each week, just search for MedicCast EMS app. And if you already have it, make sure you go back and leave a comment and rate the app. Be an active supporter of the MedicCast community and let other folks know about how they can use the app to get their information every week. That's enough contact information. I'll go ahead and get on into this week's news coming up next. Remember, support our sponsors, folks. They help bring the show to you each week, and you need to let them know you heard about them here on the MedicCast and thank them for supporting the show. Kicking off the news this week is a look at the most common symptoms of acute myocardial infarction, AMI, for men and women, and their predictive nature to confirm the presence of heart attack versus some of the other possible causes that might mimic an MI. The study in question was specifically looking at whether focusing on women-specific symptoms were more predictive than other diagnostic techniques. Researchers out of Switzerland published the study recently in the Journal of the American Medical Association's Internal Medicine. And what they found was that these particular chest pain characteristics might not be as predictive as previously thought. The prevailing thought now is that women present significantly differently with AMI than men do, and that providers have been missing the sex-specific symptoms that go along with it. I've talked about how women present differently here on the show, talking about it quite frequently. This study had nearly 800 women and 1,700 men with acute chest pain, and it's maybe contradicting this prevailing thought that we're missing women's symptoms. The researchers noted no difference in the predictive nature of sex-specific symptoms between men and women, and they emphasized in their conclusions that definitive diagnosis was still only through the presence of ECG characteristics like ST elevation seen in STEMIs and the positive blood test for cardiac troponin markers. Now we, as EMTs and paramedics, we need to maintain our vigilance for all unusual presentations accompanying chest pain, discomfort, pressure, shortness of breath. I always fall back on something my paramedic instructor told me a long time ago, saying any patient with a problem from nose to navel should get a 12 lead. Now that's a good way to look at it, and it might be using one of the only truly diagnostic tools that appears to work to confirm the presence of acute myocardial infarction in men or women. So stay alert and stay suspicious out there. Next up in the news this week is a look at one paramedic's daily life in Berkeley, South Carolina. This is a great article that's actually part of a four-part series they're doing on what it takes to become a paramedic. In this case, the reporter follows paramedic and public information officer Chris Esdorn as he leads them through the daily life of the paramedic. And they start off with things like looking at what you do at the beginning of a shift, with the inspection of your gear and your ambulance, and making sure that everything is in its place and ready to go for the next call. According to Esdorn, they carry about 3,700 items on their ambulances, and that includes breaking everything down from all the bags and all the kits on the units into individual items. I would urge you to check out this article actually for yourself and see how this agency is representing what they do, and again, educating the public about EMS in their particular community. There's absolutely no reason that you can't do something like this in your area. So as you read the article, you get to see how Esdorn carries on with the tour of the day, with a sample of what it's like going on an ambulance call, getting a complete patient history, getting that assessment information from the patient. He then goes on to talk about some of the training background that EMTs and paramedics in their region go through, including common certifications like CPR with AED, basic first aid training. He talks about the specific training and education that helps them determine not only how to treat patients, but also to determine which hospital to take them to. I think this is important to tell people about in our communities as well. So check out the article and let me know what you think of it. I think this is something that every system should do every couple of years or so to educate their public about how they do what they do in the ambulance. Finally, in the news this week, I point you to an article about a paramedic assault that occurred in Chicago recently and the charges brought against the college student involved in the attack. The article recounts an attack on a female paramedic who was trying to treat DePaul University student Eric Kawar. The paramedic responded to a call that came in for an intoxicated individual who had received a head injury after falling. When she arrived, the patient allegedly attacked her, punching her in the face and pushing her to the ground. The Cook County, Illinois state's attorney has gone ahead and charged all such crimes in their area as felonies and says that they are actually averaging one such case being charged a week, which is ridiculous, underlying the prevalence of the assaults on paramedics they're having in that area. In one way, I'm concerned by the number of attacks seen in the city, but in another way, I'm glad that the authorities are taking such attacks seriously. The next part of the equation, though, is you. You and I need to report these situations when they occur and make sure that we seek treatment if we need it and documentation of the incident by law enforcement officers. In too many areas, paramedics actually have to go and on their own time press charges against somebody if they get assaulted in the ambulance and go swear out a complaint. I think this is part of the problem. We need to talk to our local authorities. Will police take a complaint, and will the local DA file charges based on that complaint without you having to come in and file charges on your own? We should be treating these assaults just like assaults on police officers. Individuals who strike out at EMS personnel just doing their jobs are a danger to society at large. And if they'll hit a paramedic, I have to believe that they take a swing at a police officer or some other authority figure as well. So I think it's time to take charge of this problem, and we need to make sure that we, as a whole, report, charge, and prosecute all of these individuals. Our safety and the safety of our other patients depend upon it. For this week's tip of the week, I thought I'd look at something I've seen frequently in the news recently. Princeton University, if you haven't noticed over the last few weeks or months, has been dealing with a persistent outbreak of an unusual strain of bacterial meningitis, and it's actually causing the CDC to allow them to use an experimental vaccine on the students on campus. Now, this is a perfect opportunity, I think, for us to refresh what we know about meningitis. How do we manage these patients, and is there a danger to us and our families if we transport these patients? So we're going to review all of that in this week's Tip of the Week segment on bacterial meningitis for EMTs and paramedics. So let's look at bacterial meningitis in this week's segment. We're going to be covering several different things this week, including the different types of meningitis. There's lots of things that cause meningitis, and therefore different types of meningitis you might encounter. Causes specifically of bacterial meningitis, which is the meningitis that's going on or causing an outbreak right now in several colleges around the United States. We'll also look at signs and symptoms of meningitis so you can recognize it, and also cover some things that you can do in the treatment of meningitis. Finally, let's talk a little bit about some of the public health concerns and preventative measures that we can put in place to prevent the transmission of meningitis as well. So what types of meningitis are there? Well, we've talked about bacterial meningitis as the primary type of meningitis that's going on right now in the college settings. And this is the most frequently seen kind of meningitis in these settings. And interestingly enough, people are vaccinated for the common varieties that cause meningitis before they go to college in most places in the United States. I know my kids both had that vaccination given right when they were graduating from high school and moving into that highly infectious environment we call colleges. There are also anything that can cause an infection can cause meningitis or cause this to happen. So you have viral forms, fungal forms, parasitic meningitis, and there are also non-infectious meningitises, which are non-infectious because they're caused by a traumatic reason, a head injury or something of that nature that would cause a swelling of the lining around the brain. And so when the meninges swell for other reasons related to trauma or something, it's considered meningitis, but it's non-transmissible because it's, of course, caused by an isolated effect. The causes of bacterial meningitis, numerous bacteria actually can cause meningitis. Interestingly enough, the types of bacteria that are more commonly seen to cause meningitis vary over the course of someone's lifetime. So different bacterial forms will cause meningitis in infants and small children than would be compared to young adults and adults or even elderly adults. So over the course of someone's lifetime, as their environment changes, as their immune systems change and ebb and flow, we have different bacteria that can cause meningitis in these individuals. Most commonly, though, for adult cases, are two bacteria that we see frequently, and these are Neisseria meningitidis and Streptococcus pneumoniae. And these are commonly vaccinated for, but as is the case in the Princeton University outbreak that's going on right now, actually a version of the Neisseria meningitidis serogroup B, which is more common in Europe and other parts of the world, is the version of the bacteria causing the problem and is not the one that is vaccinated for here in the U.S. So when you see that they are being given an experimental vaccine, it's only experimental here in the U.S. It's actually commonly given in other parts of the world, and it's just not been approved for use here in the United States because it's not a form of bacterial meningitis that we commonly see. So it was never bothered to be approved for use in the United States. But Princeton University does have conditional approval to give the vaccine to its student body, and it's available as of this time to the students and faculty and staff at Princeton University as a preventative measure to slow the spread in these cases in New Jersey. So when you see that it's an experimental vaccine, it's because it's for a form of bacterial meningitis that's more commonly seen in other parts of the world, not here in the U.S. So what makes bacterial meningitis or other forms of meningitis so dangerous and so easily transmitted? Well, some of the risk factors that make it easier to catch this disease include the age. So people that are very young or very old are more likely to be easily catch bacterial meningitis. Close community living conditions. Does that sound familiar? Yeah, it's colleges and places like preschool classrooms, places where people are living closely together. They're exchanging bodily fluids in one way or another. For instance, little kids are always constantly chewing on things and putting toys in their mouth and then putting that toy down, and somebody else comes along, picks it up, puts it in their mouth. Well, you know, and you have things like that going on in colleges as well, for instance. Anyone with an impaired immune system is also an increased risk factor for bacterial meningitis, and healthcare workers, because we can come in contact with these people. And actually, when they talk about healthcare workers, they're actually talking about laboratory workers that are dealing with identifying bacterial meningitis when it presents. There are a few isolated cases where a healthcare worker in a lab has, because of perhaps improper handling procedures or something like that, caused themselves to contract bacterial meningitis from a sample they were working upon. World travelers, as I said, this is something that happens worldwide, and different varieties of bacteria cause this in different parts of the world. So you might have been vaccinated for the common varieties here in the U.S., but when you travel elsewhere in the world, you may encounter other forms of meningitis and infectious materials causing meningitis. So whenever you travel outside the United States, it's always a good idea to check in with a healthcare professional and ask them should they get vaccinated for some other things when they're traveling, based upon where they're going in the world. And there may be recommended vaccines based upon the destination that you're traveling. So transmission, we talked a little bit about this, but close exchanges of respiratory and throat secretions. So kissing is a prime way to pass bacterial meningitis from one person to another, which is one of the reasons why college campuses have such a problem with this. Also, sharing of drinking cups. So anything that can cause exchange of saliva. We want to say that meningitis is relatively rare. It's not as infectious as the common cold or some of the other things that are floating around out there, but it is infectious. And because of the severity of the illness that it causes, it's something that you should take a lot more care about than you might ordinarily take for something like the common cold or the upper respiratory infections that float around. This is much more insidious, even though it's not as easy to catch. If you have unusually close contact with sick individuals, and this comes back to the close living conditions, you know, somebody starts to have flu-like symptoms, which are maybe early forms of the signs and symptoms of meningitis. Well, you know, they're living in a dorm room with one or two people, maybe. They live in close proximity with a whole floor of people. And so this is why, again, college campuses can be extremely likely places for this to crop up. And it's also important to note that a healthy person can act as a carrier. So you could be carrying the infection, but your immune system has fought it off to a certain extent, and you're never going to get sick with meningitis, but you can still pass it on during the early stages of your infection. So, this is one of the reasons. I mean, they only have, I think, 8 or 9 cases at the last time I checked at the Princeton University outbreak, but that had occurred over several months' time. But the outbreaks were happening spread out all over the place, and they were hard to pin down where they had started and who had actually passed the infection on to someone else. And because it's so hard to nail this down, they have to go the route of vaccinating the entire college community for something, because they just don't know who's a carrier and who isn't. Some of the signs and symptoms to keep an eye out for. I talked about basic early symptoms of being basically flu-like symptoms. So an onset of fever, a headache, especially the presentation with a stiff neck. So, you know, that going together is often a early sign of the onset of meningitis. They may experience nausea or vomiting, and also likely to have some form of photosensitivity. And this is because, you know, we're putting increased pressure on the brain. And so all aspects of our neurological responses to things, including our sensory responses, are going to be impaired or otherwise affected. And photosensitivity is one of the ways that you may notice. So when you start putting the pieces of the puzzle together and someone is bothered by bright light, this might be something that clues you in that you're dealing with someone that isn't just dealing with a sick person or somebody with the flu, but maybe they have meningitis. Late stages, as the increased intracranial pressure continues to advance, a person may begin to experience altered mental status, decreased level of consciousness, and eventually signs of increased intracranial pressure, which is Cushing's triad, if you remember that. This can be best defined as increased blood pressure, irregular breathing, and bradycardia. And so those three signs altogether are signs of increased intracranial pressure, and is a late sign and an ominous sign for those individuals that have meningitis. So if you have somebody who's been sick for a period of time and they're now unresponsive and they're starting to show signs of Cushing's triad, you might want to suspect that this person has, in the absence of a traumatic injury, they may be experiencing meningitis, and you should be suspicious of that. So what do we do to treat these patients? Well, if you're looking at the pre-hospital setting, there's not a whole lot we can do other than palliative care. These patients in bacterial meningitis situations need antibiotics and supportive care. So in the field and in the ER, O2 IV monitor for this patient. If you have the ability to start antibiotics in the field, you may want to start antibiotics. Depending on the type of bacteria that's causing it or the most common causes, they may be given a broad spectrum antibiotic to begin with while they culture the bacteria to see what is specifically causing the meningitis. You might want to just help the patient be more comfortable. And some of the things you can do to do that include reducing the sensory input to their system. And this means maintaining a quiet environment and also dimming the lights, whether it's turning the lights down in the ER or dimming the lights in the back of an ambulance compartment. All of these things can help the patient be more comfortable as they're being cared for in the early stages of the disease. Also reduce their anxiety level. They're sick and they know they're not feeling good and they're worried. Maybe they know that meningitis is going around and they know their symptoms are reflective of meningitis, and that's why they called you. Well, or that's why they went to the ER. Well, reducing their anxiety level and tell them that, you know, you're there to take care of them, that you're going to help them feel a little bit better while we get them the care that they need, and help them relax, because they're dealing with a major headache and they're not feeling good and they're anxious. And these things can all increase their blood pressure and increase their intracranial pressures ultimately. So we need to try to avoid that and reduce their anxiety. If you're in an ambulance, they need to be rapidly transported to the hospital, especially because you don't likely carry antibiotics on board. So they need to get somewhere where they can get antibiotics started as quickly as possible if you suspect meningitis is the case for these patients. Of course, the best way to deal with meningitis is to prevent meningitis. And I've talked a lot in this segment about using vaccination appropriately and making sure people are vaccinated. So the most effective treatment is vaccination. if you, obviously in the case of the Princeton outbreak, this was not going to help them because it was a strain that was not commonly vaccinated for in the U.S. However, because vaccination is common in the U.S. for the ones that we would expect to see, it's one of the reasons why we don't have more outbreaks. And so it's hard to prove a negative, but we can certainly say that we would have more meningitis outbreaks than we currently have because colleges require the students to be vaccinated before they come to campus. And I think that's something we need to support. And we need to encourage people and remind them that vaccines are safe, that the side effects are few and relatively easy to manage, and that the use of a vaccine is going to ultimately protect you and those around you from illness over a long-term basis. And that's a good thing. Sometimes in situations, you may want to include prophylactic antibiotic use for people that are in close proximity with someone who's infectious with a meningitis. So someone in your household has meningitis, you may be asked to start a regimen of antibiotics to prevent the onset if it was transmitted to you. This may include healthcare workers, but I would rely on your medical director and your physician at the ER to let you know whether or not you need to be worrying about that. They might just ask you to be more vigilant of your own personal health and welfare for the next week or so, and see if, you know, report if you begin to have signs of flu-like symptoms, and then they can go ahead and culture and see if you have been infected or not. But generally, we need to just take universal precautions, and I think that that'll protect us most of the time, especially hand washing. You know, it comes up again and again and again, but how many of you wash your hands after every single patient, after every time you clean the back of your ambulance before another call? You have to clean and wash your hands thoroughly before you go out on that next call. That's going to not only protect you from getting infected, but also prevent the spread of infection to another sick individual who has one problem and suddenly finds out they're going to have two problems because you've infected them with something else. So hand washing and proper cleaning of the unit is very important. And, you know, after you handle a patient like this, you know, don't share cups. And you shouldn't be smoking anyway, but don't share cigarettes or anything else that could come in contact with your hands after you've handled one of these patients, unless you've very thoroughly washed your hands first. I've got a lot of good references, so I urge you to follow up in the show notes for this episode. There's great resources on meningitis over at the CDC site at cdc.gov. So you can go to their page, just go to CDC page and search meningitis. They have a whole main page that send you to hundreds of different resources based upon what you're specifically looking for. So start there. There's also a great article I found over at emsworld.com on the responder's guide to meningitis, great article by Kevin Colopy. And if you've ever read any of his stuff before, you know, it's very thorough, very well thought out, and a great resource. And you might also check out the National Institutes of Health Medline Plus page on meningitis in the medical encyclopedia there, a great reference resource in layman's terms. So that's a good resource to refer patients to and family members of patients to. It explains meningitis in easy to understand terms. And heck, I use it too, because sometimes it just needs to get into my thick skull in a different way, and that helps do it. So check out these references and follow up for more information on meningitis. That's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank all of you for checking out the show this week and remind you to follow up on all of the information from this week's show. You'll find it over at mediccast.com/blog. Over there, you'll find a link in the show notes for the top of the at the top of the page. Go ahead and take a moment and follow up on the information and the links to news items and other things you'll find there each week. You can also sign up for the email newsletter. That's right there on the right-hand side of the page. Put in your name and email address, and it'll bring those links directly to your email inbox each week. So just fill that out and get that right to you and get the MedicCast weekly newsletter. I also welcome your comments and your suggestions by email directly. So shoot me an email to podmedic@mac.com and send in your ideas for future episodes, like today's topic of traumatic asphyxiation. Send in your interview segments or whatever comments you have. I look forward to hearing from you, and I'll make sure I get back to you. I work hard to respond back to every email that comes in, so please keep those emails coming. If you want to catch up with me on social media sites or social media pages, well, you can find me most places under the handle PodMedic. So go ahead and catch me over on Twitter at twitter.com/podmedic or over on Facebook, facebook.com/podmedic. Make sure you friend or follow me over there so we can catch up online. And don't forget to check out the MedicCast Facebook page. We have almost 5,000 followers right now. So head over and check out the page over at facebook.com/mediccast. Click the like button at the top of the page and join our community over there. That's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. Please make sure you spread the word and share the MedicCast with people you know, your colleagues, your students, if you're an EMS instructor, friends in the EMS world, and let them know about the show. I'll be back here each week with new episodes, interviews, tips, and more every Monday morning to start off your EMS week. So tell somebody else about the MedicCast today. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. It's time to close out the show. Don't forget to thank our sponsors, and remember, most importantly, folks, Scene Safety, BSI.